Today on the 21st Show, the campaign to be the next U.S. Senator from Illinois. We'll have the seventh in our series of conversations. Democrat Owisi Bustos has worked as a nonprofit executive and in government, including as an aide for retiring Senator Dick Durbin. We'll talk with her about domestic policy, foreign affairs, and politics in an era dominated by President Donald Trump and MAGA. We also want to put your questions to the candidate, so you can call us throughout the hour at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. I'm Brian Mackey with Owisi Bustos for the hour today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're continuing our series of candidate interviews in the run-up to the March Democratic and Republican primaries for U.S. Senate in Illinois. This is our seventh conversation. You can listen to previous ones at 21stshow.org. Owisi Corte Bustos is running on the Democratic side. She previously worked for retiring Senator Dick Durbin for 5 years as one of his aides based in the Quad Cities. She's also worked for the state of Illinois as well as in the private sector, and she's a first-generation Ghanaian American. She was born in Benin to two Ghanaian parents, one of whom was a diplomat and civil servant. Her childhood took her around the world, from the United States to Belgium, Ethiopia, and Cuba. She attended college in the U.S., earning a bachelor's degree in political science and government from Purdue University. After that, she worked as an intern for the United Nations Economic Commission for Africa and has worked in multiple capacities for the state of Illinois. Eventually, as I mentioned, she became an aide for Dick Durbin. And while she was doing that work, she earned a law degree from the University of Illinois Chicago. More recently, she served as senior policy advisor for the Illinois Department of Human Services. And before running for Senate, she moved into the world of nonprofits as executive director of the state's Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs. Owisi Bustos joins us live from our Urbana studios. Owisi, welcome to the 21st Show.
Brian, thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, as always, we have a lot to get to. We're going to talk about Bustos' background, foreign affairs, domestic policy, some bigger themes in American government and politics as well. We also want your questions for Bustos. You can join the conversation throughout the hour. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right. I mentioned you grew up all around the world. I wonder, tell me about that. What was that like being a diplomat's kid?
Well, thank you for asking. So I would say hindsight is always 20/20. As a child, it wasn't so fun. But now that I have the benefit of experience, I'm very much appreciative for the experiences, you know, living all over the world and engaging with people from diverse backgrounds and cultures on a very human level. You learn to see more of our collective similarities and what unifies us to the core as humans versus our differences. It also enables you to kind of function in any situation and adapt. And most importantly, you see the beauty of what makes us all human, of human beings in general, our hearts, the way we engage with family, the things that we value. And I think that's pretty neat as an adult to tie that into your love for humanity, for public service, for making a difference and impact in this world. And that pretty much drives why I do what I do.
I have to ask about living in Cuba. When were you there? What was it like when you were there?
So in Cuba, it was during 2001, right before I came to the U.S. And one of the things that I love about Cuba was that it's very much as a Ghanaian, the African culture, Afro-Caribbean culture, where they were very warm, very jovial, just amazing and beautiful people. So it was Cuba is the closest to home I've been. And aside from being in the U.S., and it was one of those experiences that kind of solidified how interconnected we all are, if anything.
I'm sure you were quite young, but interestingly, that's just 2 years after Illinois Governor George Ryan at the time visited Cuba, the first Illinois governor to do so since the embargo in the 60s. So what brings you to the U.S.? Why did you choose the U.S. and Illinois specifically as a child of the world?
So I would say Illinois chose me, you know, by accident. I feel like it was a beautiful connection. The map of Ghana actually looks and shapes very similarly to Illinois. So sometimes when I look at why I love the state so much, I think I found, you know, my home away from home here. And what, you know, brought me to Illinois was my quest to have impact, to follow in my father's footsteps as an international dignitary and civil servant. And I've just always been passionate about helping people, about the world, and about connecting my love for humanity, my love for public service, foreign policy, with government and serving. And so, you know, looking, literally Googled how to get into government after I graduated and served at the United Nations, and the Governor Quinn's fellowship popped up, and I just, in my normal Luisi fashion, bombarded them with applications, and it was relentless. I was like, you are not going to ignore me. And I got a phone call, and I just packed my bags without having any connection or family, left my family in, you know, Dyer, Indiana at the time, and just relocated to Springfield. And I've been here ever since, and I haven't left. So,
you know, we're at a time where immigration and citizenship is so contested in America today. What can you talk about the decision and the process of citizenship for you in America?
So for me, I think if you think about citizenship and what ties us to land and to country and to humanity, it's a very personal story, right? But like, one of the things that's very beautiful about the United States is that we all come from somewhere. No one aside from Native Americans are inhabitants of this land. And I think part of the bedrock of this country and the strength of this country is if you look at the greatest inventors, writers, contributors, politicians, they were all, this is a country founded by immigrants, built on immigrant labor, you know, and so it's almost like no one really owns or has rights to land, I think. And it's the more we open up our hearts and our borders, the more enriched this country becomes. And if we just tie into the history of this country and all the great things that we have accomplished, our strength is definitely in the diversity and the breadth and scope of all the people that make up this country and that call this place home. So that's what citizenship and being a citizen of this great country means to me.
What has it been like for you to hear the way, you know, Stephen Miller, a top presidential aide, talks about people who are immigrants, the way President Trump himself talks about, I don't know if he's ever singled out Ghana, but certainly other countries in Africa. He's had some choice language to describe them. Listeners can remember what that is. We can't say it on the radio, but I wonder how you hear that.
So that's an interesting question, and thank you for asking that. As a child of a diplomat, programmed to function the way I function in the world, you look at the beauty and the humanity and the dignity in people, right? I am the product of so much internationally, by virtue of lived experience and by career and path, and also by virtue of what's inside of me, right? And so watching a level of disparity or disparaging other people, other cultures, other it's disheartening on the human soul level. And it's honestly the type of lack of integrity, tact, and just what is dignified of a leader of any place, let alone a place as great as the United States, right? I think ultimately, I don't internalize anything. My greatest accomplishments and my experiences in life have led me to know that the more people know about you, the more you're open and honest about what makes your culture different and learning about other people's cultures and places, the more you realize that we're all the same, right? You know, crazy analogy or crazy thought here. If we were to be invaded by aliens tomorrow, all of human beings would literally get together and fight the aliens, right? It wouldn't matter whether you're Mexican, Ghanaian, Jewish, white, black, yellow, green, blue. It really doesn't matter. We're all human. And I think I'd like to think that that is what we all need to keep front and center, is that we all have one life to live on this earth. Everyone wants to just make the best of their existence, and they have a God-given, dignified, universal human right to that and to not have anything interfere with that. So that's where I anchor in, and I anchor in the promise of this country and the history, and that is the blueprint for what the future will look like and should look like.
I like that analogy of the alien invasion, though I got to say, the green and blue people, you may want to watch out for them, so they could be on the other side. All right, we are talking with Owisi Bustos, who is running in the Democratic primary for United States Senate in Illinois, 800-222-9455 to join us today. So the big question, why do you want to be a United States Senator?
Well, honestly, when I look at the breadth and scope of all of my experiences, the question is, why not, right? I mean, I've heard, you know, a lot of positives and, you know, I guess whatever the naysayers might be, but I don't anchor. And I think public service is not something that you are entitled to. It's a privilege. Serving people is a privilege. It's not easy to get up, especially in this political climate where politics and government and being a politician, I like to look at myself as a public servant, not a politician. It's like a four-letter word, right? But if you really focus on the why, from the experience as a nonprofit executive and the experience working at the intersection of policy and government, building and collaborating with some of the brightest minds and working on the social connectivity and the basics of governance and what public service should actually be. The answer is clear to me. I want to make an impact. I want to make a difference. And I want everyone to know that you don't have to come from a specific background or have a specific script. As long as you meet the requirements of what the Constitution says, as long as you're a genuine human and you really want to serve and make a difference in your life, and in the lives of others, and see the, you know, be the change that you want to see in the world, then ultimately, you know, what's meant to be will be, and it's a beautiful thing. So that's why I want to serve in this capacity, because I have the skill set and the passion, and I want to serve people and be a contributor.
So it's interesting because the field of Democratic candidates this year seems divided. There are at least three candidates who have long experience either in Congress or in Illinois politics, the Lieutenant Governor, Congresswoman Robin Kelly, Lieutenant Governor Stratton, and Congressman Roger Krishnamurti. And then there are a number of candidates like you who this would be their first time in elected office. Why aim so high, right? Why not start with the park board or school board or even state legislature?
I'm glad you asked that question. And so if you look at my career, and I know you have, so thank you for, you know, the background that you shared about me. It's the United States Senate seat is a very unique seat in terms of it's a policy seat. It's a diplomacy seat. It's a seat that you are the intersector and connector of not only the state of Illinois representing your state, but you're also connecting other states. You're also dealing with foreign policy and effectuating foreign policy. There's also a legal aspect and element to that. So asking me that question would be equivalent to asking me, why am I not a surgeon or a carpenter? It's not a question of something is above or beneath me or high or low. It's a question of what your passions are, what your specific unique skill sets are, and how you feel you can serve your country and your state. And this is where I have been passionate about, and my trajectory in my career has been very specific since I set foot in Springfield, Illinois. And this is the next step in my projection in order to be able to use all the collective experience that I have in order to serve the people of Illinois in a unique way that I think, especially in this climate, you need senators who have an understanding of foreign policy as well as the intricacies of downstate Illinois and Chicago and what makes this country unique. So that's what I bring to the table, a different kind of experience, but nevertheless just as experienced and just as qualified.
Well, that's an interesting analogy, though, because I think, you know, people would look at medicine and say, well, you have to get a degree in, you know, probably biology and then go to medical school and then do your residency and, you know, maybe a fellowship before mm-hmm. you're, you know, a truly qualified surgeon. You say, though, I mean, so, yeah, I mean, talk about your experience as it relates to why you think you're qualified for Senate then.
And so, you know, I've served the state of Illinois in policy and government for almost 2 decades. Served as a director of policy and training for Illinois' Guardianship and Advocacy Commission, where I dealt with issues on advocacy and mental health and guardianship issues statewide for adults with disabilities. Served as a, you know, staffer, Northwest Illinois coordinator for Senator Durbin, working directly in his office, engaging with constituents on varied issues. Served Governor Quinn in his administration. Served as a CEO, executive director for the Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs statewide. I think for me, the experience speaks for itself, and there's so many ways to serve people, and you don't have to be in an actual sitting political office to actually know what policy is, know what the laws are, know how it intersects and affects constituents. And if anything, the staffers and who do the work, who do the research, who do the policy, who engage with the constituents are, if at the very least, the most qualified to serve, because they actually have a pulse and an ear to the ground on what are the issues that are core and near and dear to people.
All right. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are speaking with Owisi Bustos, one of the people running in the Democratic primary for United States Senate this year here in Illinois. The election is coming up in mid-March. March 17th is Election Day. But of course, early voting is going to be opening this month at different times in different parts of Illinois. Check your local listings, as they say. If you want to join us today, the number is 800-222-9455. When we get back from a short break, we're going to start delving into policy, both foreign and domestic. Again, 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. More with Owisi Bustos after a short break. This is the 21st show. Stay with us. It's the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. Our guest for the hour today is Owisi Bustos, one of the women and men running in the Democratic primary for United States Senate in Illinois this year. You can join us at 800-222-9455. As we were talking about in the first part of the hour, Bustos is an attorney. She's worked for the state of Illinois as well as an aide for United States Senator Dick Durbin. Again, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. All right, let's get into policy. What do you think about the Trump administration's capture of Venezuela's president last month?
I believe that was a sad day for international law, for international collaboration and state sovereignty. People can argue one way or the other based on which way you fall on the issue. But ultimately, the litmus test is if the same thing were reversed, if roles were reversed and another country did the same thing to the United States for the same reasons. And people could argue that Trump, being the president is a very polarizing figure internationally. How would that cut, right? We've come along, and when we look at that, you think international law, diplomacy, foreign policy, the UN conventions, and all the things that hold the line only work if all parties are following by the rules, right? And that is the fine thread and line that we all have to walk. If no one follows the rules, then we live in anarchy, both domestically and internationally. And so you want to be respected. You want people to see you as a superpower and a leader in the space. Well, there's legitimate, leadership. There's legitimate power. And when you do things and operate in illegitimate ways that are condemned by various trusted voices and leaders in a certain space, you are kind of undermining and diminishing that. So that's what I feel about that act. I think it's a very, very dangerous precedent to set. And we need to go back to the United States being the beacon of hope and the leader that it has always been, and operating with a certain level of tact, diplomacy, and deference to state sovereignty if it wants other countries to respect its state sovereignty and its citizens who also are, you know, live abroad in other countries. So
what about, there are those who say, yes, it was probably, and from a domestic law standpoint as well. I saw Senator Rand Paul making this argument with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, I believe, last week in a congressional hearing. But there are those who say, well, Maduro was a pretty bad guy. He was himself an illegitimate president who seemed to have stolen the last election. And so good riddance. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's not good enough, right? Whatever the case may be, he was recognized as a head of state by the United Nations and other bodies. And there is a democratically elected process for that. And I think ultimately, you don't get to violate other people's rights and other people's sovereignty just because you have a singular opinion. Like, that is the most absurd notion. I mean, I can't even wrap my mind around that. If that's the case, then the United Nations has mechanisms. Like, no one is above the law, and we don't take the law into our own hands. I don't go to my neighbor just because I think he's a pretty bad guy, and I take matters into my own hands. I go to the authorities, and I exercise the legal avenues and the mechanisms that are available to me. And that is the ballpark. You know, it's like people, whatever could be said about Maduro, a lot of people could say the same thing about Trump. So again, if the roles were reversed, would that be acceptable? And if the answer is no, then the answer is no all around.
What should the U.S. Senate, particularly with Democrats in a minority position right now, and potentially after the next election, it's not clear whether they'll be able to take back the majority. In fact, that still seems to be a long shot, a lot of the pundits say. But what should the U.S. Senate be doing to check the executive branch on this?
I think it should go back to reinforcing, the presidential powers, reinforcing the fact that certain actions do require congressional authority. Clearly, that is currently the state of the law. However, this still happened. And so going back to the drawing board and figuring out what are the loopholes, what are the ways in which these types of unprecedented international violations occur and work, you know, collaboratively in the most bipartisan and legal way possible to ensure that these types of, you know, violations of freedom of speech, violations of international law and conventions, violations of norms, violations of even our internal processes and constitutional checks and balances don't happen, right? Obviously, it's a lot easier said than done, but ultimately, there are a lot of smart experts at the table and legal experts on both sides. And it all boils down to the United States going back to the drawing board and understanding that there was a point in time in this country where it didn't really matter what party you were from, was right, and was wrong, was wrong. We can argue and defer and have differences about, you know, whether you have conservative policies economically or liberal or whether on social issues, all those things. But we're all here to serve our state and serve our individual regions to the best of our ability. But when it comes to what the Constitution prescribes and how that should be enacted, those are non-negotiables. Those are crystal clear. And so there needs to be a going back to that thought process of an assault on, and this kind of behavior is an assault on what keeps us all safe. You know, anarchy, violating constitutional boundaries and checks and balances that our forefathers thought of and universally and collaboratively worked to get to where we are. This is a dismantling of all of that. And, you know, going back to the words that, you know, the president used for some of these other countries that you mentioned, that's pretty much what it's looking like for the United States. You know, we're going to be we are close to being and on track to being one of the countries he talks about if we don't, you know, reverse course and start operating within the fundamental values on which this country was built.
Another area of foreign affairs that is of great interest to Senator Durbin, again, for whom you were an aide in the past, and the other Illinois U.S. Senator, Tammy Duckworth, is Ukraine. Do you think the United States has an interest in a free Ukraine?
Absolutely. I believe every nation has a right to be autonomous and to be sovereign. You know, this is not the 1920s. This is not the era of colonization and all the mistakes of the past. We operate in modern times with a lot of advancements and knowledge politically, and countries and borders have been set, and we have avenues for negotiating and collaborating with respect and dignity for the autonomy and sovereignty of individual nations. And I think in order to secure all of our borders, we need to apply that same logic externally to others. That is just, you know, I mean, it's the golden rule, and there's a reason for that, and that applies to life and our interpersonal connections and interpersonal relations, and it also applies to foreign policy and how we relate to other countries and other regions of the world.
It's been more than 2 years since Israel, or I should say Israel, was attacked by Hamas back in October of 2023. There have been tens of thousands of Palestinians who were killed during that time. It was just within the last week that the last Israeli hostage's body was returned. There's been a lot of conversation about how to think about what's happening there. Do you think that Israel's response constitutes a genocide?
Absolutely. And we can go by, again, what the definition set by the United Nations. I mean, there is legal precedence and cases, South Africa and the lawsuit. So, and these definitions, in theory and legally, are there, but also morally and just by human norms and spirits. I mean, you know what carnage looks like. You know what disparaging and lack in proportionality and fairness and equity looks like, right? So, you know, there are different thoughts about the issues based on what alliance is, but ultimately going back to the Holocaust and looking at those definitions and looking at what rose to the level of those protections that were set and implemented internationally and interventions for Jewish people, you apply the same rule and the same stick to this particular situation. And that's that.
What are the implications of that then for U.S. policy as it relates to Israel?
I think ultimately there is diplomacy and respect for autonomy for all people, and that autonomy and dignity to have a sovereign state should not come at the expense of one state over the other, right? I think for me, just breaking it down on a very basic level, if I have a friend that is misbehaving or not acting morally by known, widely accepted measures of what comports good behavior and interactions, I'm not following just because we're friends, right? You owe it to that person to stand on the side of the truth and honesty and legitimacy and just try to work ways to collaborate, but also standing on the side of justice. And so whatever that means for the U.S., it means ensuring that the measures that were applied, you know, in the Holocaust and the same heart and spirit for people and for life, and that led to those types of interventions should be applied for the Palestinian people. Or if the United States was in that position, again, going back to it, what would you want done for you if we were Palestinians? I mean,
Should America recognize a Palestinian state?
Yes. There should be a two-state solution. Yes, there should absolutely be. And you know, being an American citizen, but also having global connections to the world, and as a Ghanaian American who very much remembers what colonization was like through the history books in 1960s with Ghana, like, you, unless this is part of your history and your lineage, it feels differently. And the same way Americans feel passionate about their country and defending their sovereignty and defending their land is the same way other nations feel about that.
Is who would be one of the things you hear from supporters of Israel, critics of the two-state solution, at least as it is, as it would be soon, anytime soon, is who would be on the other side? Who would be the government of the Palestinian people?
I think you would take it to the UN, right? And you would bring the Palestinian people to the table. And you would work that out in the most collaborative and most open, basic way possible in terms of getting to the root cause of this, right? I mean, yeah, that's where the answer would be. So I don't have off the top of my head an answer, but it goes to having the right people at the table with the United Nations and those bodies and giving the Palestinians a voice in self-determination, which is what we all deserve and want and have a right to.
You know, one thread that I think runs through all these conversations that have been happening in America in the past few years, maybe arguably the past few decades, whether it's about Israel and Palestine or Greenland or Venezuela or Iran, is whether America should really continue to seek to be a global superpower. How do you feel about that?
I think the question should be, prior to that, where is America's moral compass and moral authority? You know, that should be paramount. I think the actions of the past couple of years have quickly exasperated U.S. foreign policy in a way where even our strong allies are turning their backs on us, right? This country has quickly become the world's bully, and it's really sad to see. And on one hand, you know, you can say you get what you want at all costs, but that's a very short-sighted view and approach to living and operating in a world where you very much need friends to survive, because, you know, you need natural resources that aren't all on this land and that are heavily dependent on other people and their autonomy and right to exist. And so prior to focusing on being a world leader and a superpower, we need to get our house in order, and we need to ensure that we are operating in with foreign policy that has dignity and respect for the rule of law and respect for human rights, both domestically within our borders and abroad, applied to other people and other nations.
Would you support the reinstatement of USAID or reconstituting it in some way? This is, of course, the foreign aid program that the Trump administration's special employee, Elon Musk, quote unquote, spent the weekend feeding into the wood chipper. What do you think about that?
I would say absolutely, because a large majority of the world relies and depends on that. And that is part of the U.S.'s foundation for, you know, global will and foreign policy and collaboration and good faith with other nations, right? There's a lot of disparity in this world, and we can go, you know, back to history and the historic factual reasons why certain countries are where they are economically and why others are. But ultimately, the point is, you know, taking care of your neighbors and ensuring that human rights interventions and aid that actually save lives and help people, those need to be reinstated, because a lot of humanity depends on that.
All right. If you're just joining us, it's the 21st show. We're talking with Owisi Bustos, running in the Democratic primary for United States Senator from Illinois, of course, to succeed the retiring United States Senator Dick Durbin, for whom Bustos worked for a time as an aide in the Quad Cities. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. We're going to turn to domestic policy after a short break. This is the 21st show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today with Owisi Bustos, who is among the Democrats running to succeed Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin in the primary, which is coming up, of course, in March, although early voting begins this month at different times in different parts of Illinois. Check your local listings. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. Let's talk about domestic policy. We've seen now the killing of two American citizens in Minneapolis, Alex Pretty and Renee Good. Should we abolish ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
I believe that there needs to be reform. There needs to be an adherence to the rights of U.S. citizens. Currently, this militarization of that department is in complete contradiction and violation to its intended purpose and also to what is allowed and prescribed by the Constitution. And so Congress really needs to go back to the drawing board and ensure that individuals who are hired to serve and protect are actually serving and protecting, and that immigration reform and policies should be adhering to, you know, constitutional checks and balances and the right level of appropriate behaviors that are dignified of public servants, because that is what they are. They're public servants. And
so I can understand, and it makes sense what you're saying about Congress, you know, sort of in the future, especially looking at who is in these positions. Do you think Democrats, and whether it's through congressional investigations or perhaps a future Democratic presidential administration, should pursue accountability for what's happening now, either, you know, civil, criminal, however you want to take it?
100%. Absolutely. I mean, people are losing loved ones senselessly. Immigrants and United States citizens, legal citizens, are being terrorized. I mean, we are living in very unprecedented times where, I mean, it's completely absurd and unfathomable what is happening, and it's really disheartening. It's an attack on the bedrock and foundation and principles of this nation. It's an attack on citizens. It's an attack on freedom of speech. It's an attack on you know, individual rights and civil rights, and there needs to be an atoning. There needs to be an atoning and an accountability for the damage that this era is doing psychologically, physically, and emotionally to all American citizens.
What should America's border policy be, right? It often gets boiled down to this sort of cartoonish closed borders, open borders dyad. The Biden administration was widely criticized for having pretty lax border enforcement for most of the term. How do you think about what happened then?
So I think there was legislation that almost passed that was bipartisanly supported that addressed some of these issues. That is a foundation. And so that could be going back to that drawing board and ensuring that we're having, you know, the experts, the right level of experts at the table from both sides, really and honestly assessing the situation with direct introspection of this current times and what's going wrong, and ensuring that we are enacting policies that aren't equivalent to cutting our noses to spite our faces, right? I mean, there really needs to be an intentionality behind enforcing border and immigration laws, but with adherence to human rights and to treating individuals with a level of dignity and civility that is reflective of the fundamental values and principles of this nation and its foundation.
All right, I want to be mindful of the fact that we only have about 10 minutes left in the program today. So another area of domestic policy that people tell pollsters is still of great interest to them is the economy. Affordability is how this is often talked about now. What can the federal government do to improve the economy, especially, you know, as you get farther down the income and wealth spectrum in American life?
I would say understanding how the tariffs and the U.S.'s foreign policy is actually affecting affordability and driving prices, ensuring that there is a balance in taxation where the wealthiest billionaires are paying their fair share, ensuring that all of the social services and safety net infrastructures that enable the most needy of society to survive, that we are actually approaching things with an eye for human dignity and human rights. But mainly, you know, these tariffs aren't helping. You know, there's so many economic policies that could be enacted, and having the right leadership and the right experts at the table to figure things out and think through what's working, what isn't working, and where the areas of opportunities are. But just on a broad stroke, just ensuring that the U.S. isn't really as reactionary as it has been in its foreign policy, that actually does a lot more to harm American citizens, whether it's the farmers, whether it's the cost of produce, whether it's the cost of raw materials, whether it's our 401ks and our investments. All these things are affected by the instability and the chaos that is going on around the world.
Your campaign website, excuse me, your campaign's website mentions responsible AI policy as one of your platform points. What does that look like?
So what it looks like is ensuring that, for instance, you know, as AI advances and technology advances, we need to ensure that these advancements don't come at the expense of the environment. Some of these data centers and the amount of water that it's required, the amount of energy and emissions and weight on the planet, ensure that also this AI protects the right to privacy and information of people and children especially, and ensuring that AI isn't replacing human labor, right? It's meant to enhance and make better and help, but not putting people out of jobs and inevitably causing more of the disparities in the workforce and in the economy that affects people, and that it's actually building on skills and equipping people to thrive.
Yeah, whether it creates a mass leisure class, I guess that's a conversation we can have. What you haven't mentioned, though, this idea of catastrophic existential risk, right? P-doom is the term that AI people use to describe the probability of a catastrophic outcome from 0 to 100%. What's your P-doom?
I would say, I mean, at this point, we're maybe at a 50%. I like to be more optimistic.
50% optimistic?
Well, I mean, in terms of being realistic, right? I mean, if you look at the data centers and all the leaders in this space who are warning us, right? I mean, you need to be realistic about that. But ensuring that we are putting in research in reversing or curtailing some of these adverse effects. So yes, I mean, I would say measuring it in that capacity puts the level of seriousness and severity to the situation that I feel is actually what we're experiencing right now. But there's hope. So
A couple of quick, more domestic policy points, and I know these are deep topics. They can be, but do you own a personal firearm?
I do not.
How do you relate to voters who are gun owners who think Democrats, you know, want to, quote unquote, take their guns away?
I believe in the Constitution, and I believe in your right to bear arms, and I believe in everyone's right to bear arms. And so ultimately that has to be balanced. That has to be balanced with ensuring that public safety, you know, school shootings are some of the most pressing issues to me. And so how do we enter a world where we don't have every other day a rinse and repeat of some of school children being harmed by, you know, access to firearms, right? And so again, going back to bringing the leaders to the table, including gun rights activists, and also ensuring that we are being fair and honest about the discussions and the root causes, where we're preserving the right to bear arms, in contrast to ensuring that our children are safe and that our streets are safe and that there is like responsible gun laws and gun ownership.
A couple of Senate sort of procedural questions that are going to face Democrats in the future. Sam in Springfield sent us a text message, wants to know if you would vote for a new Democratic leader to replace Schumer.
I would say currently with the state of affairs, I believe that it's time to have new leadership, right? I mean, I don't know the man personally. I can just go off of the policies and just being honest, he has been effective, but there's also areas of opportunities. But most importantly, there needs to be a looking at what the future holds and what the future of the Democratic Party should be. And it's not with people who've been in office for 40 years continuing to hold power and direct the party.
Worth noting, your old boss is the number two to Schumer among Democrats in the Senate. What do you think of the filibuster? Should we get rid of it?
I think there could be more strategic ways of using it to our advantage. And so we're in the space that we're in, and we need to employ all avenues at our disposal to get this country back on track and to get the Democrats back on track, where we're actually being able to toe the line and to protect human rights and people all across this country.
Do you think Senator Durbin was right to join Republicans during the government shutdown late last year to end that shutdown?
It would not be a choice that I would have made, especially with all the things that we knew at that time. And all the things that we know now that are playing. But ultimately, it's easy to say what you would and would not do when you're not at the table, right? And so I respect him as a leader, and I believe that he did what he felt was the best decision at that time, and I respectfully disagree with that path. And I think ultimately your role as a senator is to listen to what your constituents want, and there was and still is an overwhelming amount of Illinois Democrats who didn't agree with that decision.
This will probably have to be our last question, but there's a debate going on now among Democrats about what you should do should you regain power, right? Investigate and impeach Trump, you know, tear down the East Wing ballroom, or let that go and focus on the price of ground beef. Where are you on that?
I would say definitely focus on the price of ground beef. I would say we learned from the first impeachment, and we are where we are. And so that would be a waste of efforts, but definitely working to collaborate, you know, nationally and set checks and balances where we can do what we can to mitigate whatever is left of this term, and then work to regain back control so we can start reversing course immediately.
Owise Bustos is among the Democrats running for United States Senate in the Democratic primary. You'll have the opportunity to vote for her or one of her opponents in March. Owise Bustos, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I should say the rest of the conversations in our series of interviews are at our website, 21stshow.org. And we have more coming up between now and the primary. If you have questions for the candidates, you can always email us. Talk@21stshow.org is the address. Talk@21stshow.org. You can find that address and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can also find links to subscribe to our podcasts or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. Coming up on tomorrow's show, African Americans were long excluded from advertising. One of the key figures in changing that was Tom Burrell of Chicago, who, starting in the 1970s, made advertising with black people, for black people. He's the subject of a biography. We'll talk with the author of that biography, Jason Chambers. Again, that's coming up tomorrow on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. I mentioned all the platforms where you can find our podcast, Apple, Spotify. I should say we're also on YouTube now. You can find us there by searching for Illinois Public Media. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.